You know, there are different ways to engage with culture. And
right.
We don't all have to file into the museum like penitent monks and stand there in front of the great Rothko and gaze at it until we have communed with the great cosmic otherness.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 210 with Dan Fox. He is a writer and editor at Frieze Magazine in New York and, mostly for our purposes here, the author of Pretentiousness, Why It Matters, a book that he wrote that came out in 2016. He did the book tour. He came back into the public's consciousness through this podcast. And as it turns out, pretentiousness is a word and a concept that is a door to a wide breadth of things, as he discovered when he dove down many rabbit holes in writing the book. And our conversation, likewise, does a lot of diving as well. I am Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images roughly and closely resembling many of the things that we talked about, including some very odd and perhaps entertaining cartoons that fulfill the role of addressing pretentiousness, a still from The Squid and the Whale, which I quote from as one of my examples of pretentiousness out in popular culture. Fawlty Towers is Dan's, and so on. So go check those out. You can also support the show, go find back episodes and so on. Yeah, the word pretentiousness, the concept of pretentiousness, you will never think of the same after hearing this conversation. Certainly if you read the book, which you may be motivated to do after hearing us talk. Kate Mitchell, my producer, had a chance to listen to this conversation and call Dan's perspective a much-needed, fresh approach to things. Among other things, it gave us an opportunity to talk about various facets of the art world and how pretentiousness works in the world and what people really mean by it, really honing in on what people mean by that, because too often it's a throwaway word, as it turns out. We do get into a rather, I don't know if heated is the right word, but a fairly intense debate about the relative merits of selfie photos in art museum context in particular, which I think you might find intriguing. And I think that's pretty much all you need to know. It's going to go down like butter. So enjoy. On the back end, I'm going to give you an update from the Weiss Link, a few highlights from the week in the art world, and maybe a little clarification at the end of our conversation in regards to that selfie debate we have as well. So enjoy. Thank you for being here. I will talk to you more on the back end. So I am holding in my hand a black paperback book with a giant P on the cover. And listeners will already know because I've mentioned this in the intro, but it is not, I just want to say it anyway. It's not the P of the P word as it is known on this show, but rather it is P-R-E as in pretentiousness. Mm-hmm. Why It Matters. Remind me, was it 2015 or 2016 publish?
2016.
2016, okay. And you did you do a book tour in 2016?
Yeah, I spoke in a few places in Britain where it was first published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. Mm-hmm. And then a few months later, did a few little talks in the U.S. when it was published by Coffee House Press.
Okay, so all that to say that there's been some dormancy since you were deep into the material.
There really has, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right, got it. Okay, well, thank you for letting us wake it up again.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So what is the... I'll just preface this by saying that in the acknowledgments, I believe it was, you mentioned that you had a couple of essays that you published in Frieze that then later became the book. So I could sort of put together that, you know, maybe you were doing some thought experiments and that's kind of how it came about. But was there any specific genesis to writing about pretentiousness?
Well, you're right to say that the book emerged out of a couple of different pieces that I'd written for Freeze and also elsewhere. I guess the origin of my interest in this topic comes from having spent a great deal of time working in contemporary art, and pretension, pretentiousness, it's one of those words that, you know, is hurled in your direction if you work in contemporary art, you know, quite frequently, often by people outside the industry, but sometimes within. And when I first started thinking about the topic, I was living in, I now live in New York, but I was living in London.
Yeah.
And it's the word pretentious, the word, you know, all this idea of pretension is something you find a lot in the British mainstream press, whether that's the tabloid press or the so-called broadsheets, you know, the sort of more highbrow newspapers. And it's often a word that you see used in art reviews. And I'd been loosely tracking it for a while because I'd noticed there were vastly different contexts in which it was being used. And the word seemed to have a kind of, it seemed to be a catch-all for certain critics for anything they didn't like.
Right.
And I was unable to kind of entirely square their accusations of pretension when thrown at, you know, exhibitions or artists, especially those artists who I knew personally, and what I knew to be the reality of the lives led by the people that make these things. So, you know, an artist accused of pretension, I happen to know, you know, was, you know, struggling with like two day jobs and was probably the most down to earth person you could possibly imagine, but
right.
had an interest in art and the various kind of, you know, languages that go with contemporary art. So I think it was this gap between what I knew of the art world and people working within it and its perception by people who were maybe slightly outside it. And
right.
so I started to think about why that word gets used so often. And then that was I was down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, yeah, and speaking
and it cracked open.
Right.
You know, once I started looking at the word, it, you know, and cracked it open, just so many different, kind of thoughts and ideas and neuroses and anxieties and things like that scuttled out of it. And so, the book is an attempt to, you know, sweep those all together.
Yeah, and you do indeed, for a book that's just a little over 100 pages, like 120 pages, you do go quite deep down the rabbit hole. But one of the thing that most stood out for me in what you just said was the part where you mentioned Britain and, you know, the way that pretentiousness gets hurled around there, and we will eventually get to a passage that specifically describes that. I would say from my own experience, and you can tell me now if I'm how correct or less than correct I am, being that you have lived in London and now live in New York, that it is indeed far more commonly hurled around in the UK than it is here. I mean, I'm sure you get it from time to time in a review, and you know, and people mention it to write off shows, you know, as a shorthand for and shortcut to writing off a show or somebody's work. But I haven't encountered the word that often. That's not to say that what you get into and what we can talk about is going to strike a lot of very interesting chords. But how does that all sound to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's what it's connected to in Britain, I think, is an anxiety around class, which
right.
is something that my fellow country people are obsessed with.
Right. Right.
And I don't find in the US that people, although class, I think, is very, very much an issue here. It's
sure.
a huge issue here.
Yeah.
I don't think people talk about it in the same way they do in the UK. And so the word pretentious, I think that its usages here, as I've encountered them, are often tied up to a relationship to class and authenticity and, you know, plain speaking and being down to earth and all that kind of stuff. But certainly it really, really pushes a button in the UK, where, you know, class anxieties and neuroses are kind of, you know, are programmed into you from the moment, you know, from the day you're born.
Yeah, yeah. The last guest that I had that I can recall, and I'm pretty sure, the last guest that I had that it was British-born, Ellen Harvey, we talked a good few minutes about her accent. And I think since you address it specifically in the book, we would be remiss if we did not, before we keep going, for you to read from this passage. It's page 35 of my version, A Personal Observation. Can you read that paragraph?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A personal observation. Brits like me living in the US can speak their native tongue, but the context shapes its delivery and reception. Americans might take the English accent a variety of ways, as charming, intelligent, sexy, or cold, snooty, and condescending. On more than one occasion, an American has told me that an English accent is read as pretentious. The idea that a person's natural way of speaking is fake, presumably in relation to a US accent being real, is absurd, suggesting deeper anxieties about social status and national stereotypes. Some British expats maintain their accents, while some retune their voice to local US idioms and speech patterns. They slip and slide around words, perhaps borrow the upspeak cadences of California Valley girls. Comical though it can sound, variations in pronunciation are often practical. It's simply easier to make yourself understood in the US if you say tomato rather than tomato, or water instead of water.
Right. There was one little change, by the way, in the US version. I don't know if we should focus on this, but I do want to mention it and just see if it's of significance. So in the English version, remind me, it says, and sexy or cold, snooty. How did that go?
And condescending.
Whereas in the U.S. version, it goes, and sexy or cold, snooty, and even villainous.
Interesting choice. That's actually very good.
Yeah.
Do you want me to read that bit again?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Americans might take the English accent a variety of ways, as charming, intelligent, sexy, or cold, snooty, and even villainous.
Where to begin? Yeah, I guess my own experience is that, as with Ellen and with you, that your accents are indeed charming, and we could get into more of the detail around that. And others that I don't find charming, and this very much ties into the class thing that you refer to, I wouldn't say are cold, snooty, or villainous, but, they're just English accents. I guess, what do we want to talk about this? I guess, the thing about when you say that, for the people who have said your way of speaking sounds fake, I imagine those people in the U.S. are an analog to the people in the U.K. that fling around the word pretentious a lot. So they're analog classes, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. I think the implication in both is that you're hiding something,
mm-hmm.
and your accent is actually hiding some other kind of truth that you wish to conceal, perhaps about your background, which might reveal truths about the economic situation, the economic background that your parents come from, or where you grew up. There are geographical snobberies both here and in the UK about where people come from. It may be suggesting that, you're changing your accent, you're modifying it in order to conceal not just your identity, but maybe make out that you've got a better education than you really have.
Right.
That you come from a higher kind of class status. Or there's the flip side of that, which is a kind of deliberately sort of like downwardly mobile version, an inverted snobbery,
mm-hmm.
whereby someone will kind of affect a very, very colloquial accent, a very working class accent, in order to make out that they're real kind of salt of the earth types, or that they're just like one of the common people, and they're in touch with regular ordinary folk.
Yeah, but you being a Brit in the New York art world now for several years, I can't imagine a place where it's easier to blend in with an English accent. Is that about right?
Yeah, there's no problem here. Yeah. I mean, I think in the New York art world, I think that, you know, of course, people are used to hearing accents from all over the world. So
right,
you know, a British one is just one of many that you'd encounter in various places in the art world in New York.
Yeah. So I want to get to the, see if I can more or less accurately paint a fair thesis of your book, or if I'm off. And then I want to jump right into some of our own popular examples of pretentiousness at work. So having read the whole book, the way that you wrote about pretentiousness often was in a positive light, that there was essentially pretending and, you know, code switching, getting into a different character. You know, you write a lot about the roots of through philosophy and acting, and all that to say that one of my takeaways is kind of that you were in the process of throughout the book trying to turn the negative association of pretentiousness, the pejorative version of pretentiousness, into a positive, the way that certain words are owned by members who have been, you know, like queer is one example that comes to mind, where it's owned by the queer, you know, and turned into a positive. Does that feel like something that you were either intentionally or inadvertently doing?
Well, I realized in the course of writing the book that I could never fully reappropriate that word. It could never fully be sort of, you know, claimed for the forces of, you know, positivity, because
right.
I think that whilst these, all the kind of things that I talk about in there around acting, around pretending, also around striving to overreach yourself creatively and possibly failing in the, you know, in the attempt, all of those have analogs in more negative parts of, you know, human behavior, such as, you know, snobbery and condescension and sort of social climbing and things like that. So, you know, for every turn I took in which I was trying to get my readers to, or persuade my readers to think again about what this word means, there was always like a counterexample that would be a negative one. So I think that the book doesn't succeed in making pretentious into a completely positive term, and I'm kind of glad it doesn't. I actually like the messiness of that word. I think what I was trying to do was to try to get people to think again about what they really mean when they use that word, if they use it as an insult or not, and what is it that they're really referring to, and what do you think, what is it they're really doing when they use that word? Because it's, you know, it's used in quite a variety of different contexts, as I've mentioned. You know, you find it not just in conversations about art and cinema, music, whatever, but, you know, around food or around cars or around language or around, you know, real estate or, you know, so many different topics. But it can be a very powerful put down, and I think it can be a very damaging put down. I just wanted to sort of maybe suggest to people that, you know, when they use that word, when they think about that word, maybe just tread a bit more gently, tread a bit more lightly. Think about what it is you're doing when you use that word, and think about what it means, what when you use it, it's saying about you as a person.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of ultimately what I was trying to do with the book.
Right. On a practical level, now, when you're writing and since you've written the book, in situations where people in person, when they throw out that word and do it in such a way, which I would imagine most of the time is not to your level of satisfaction, do you feel incredibly compelled to either at least say, you need to read my book, or I'm going to have to push back on you with that comment?
Well, I think that if anyone uses the word and I'm in their company and they know that I've written this book, I always get someone kind of like looking at me and raising their eyebrow when they use that word, or they use the word and then say sorry. You know, and I have, I guess, forever condemned myself to have my name associated in Google searches with the word pretentious. So people are very aware that if they're in conversation with me and I use that word, that, you know, I have a few opinions on it. I would not, you know, I don't, I'm not going to police the way people use, you know, use their words and use their language. Yeah. That's up to them. Right. But
it's tricky, Dan.
If I'm in a combative mood, then I might push back.
Yeah. You know, it, well, Dan, I can tell you from my own experience pushing back on another P word. In fact, trying to get people not to use it, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky. I'm not going to necessarily, although I haven't had the opportunity in a while, and that might change, but I'm not going to necessarily challenge somebody I don't know who tosses it out.
No.
You know, so, yeah.
Well, that's just good manners, isn't it?
Yeah, alas, it is. As I was reading the book, I think one of my kind of expectations was that you were going to get into sort of great moments of pretentiousness, you know, in cultural history. And in a way, you kind of do when you start to talk more specifically about the art world. But I was just trying to think of my own sort of whatever associations I could come up with. And I'd love to hear some of yours. I'm going to give you mine real quick. So the first one that came to mind was from the movie The Squid and the Whale. And what's interesting, if you deconstruct or dissect those characters, the main character played by
Jeff Daniels.
Okay, thank you. So Jeff Daniels, who plays the main character, and then Jesse Eisenberg plays his son. And what's interesting is that as one thinks back on that movie, they think, oh man, yeah, the main character, he was super pretentious. But in fact, he was just kind of a blowhard, you know? It was really his son who was kind of the epitome of pretentiousness. And I was looking for some quotes, and in fact, there are a couple of really nice nuggets. So one, he's talking to a friend, and he says, "It's Wells' masterpiece, really. Many people think it's Citizen Kane. But Magnificent Ambersons, if it hadn't been ruined by the studio, would have been his crowning achievement. As it is, it's still brilliant. It's the old story, genius not being recognized by the industry." Lance, his friend, says, "Sounds great. Who's in it? Orson Welles? I don't know. I haven't seen it yet. I've seen stills." So that's one. And then another one, which is quite priceless, is, of course, you know you're in trouble when you preface a quote by calling it priceless. So he's talking with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend Sophie says, "Yeah, I mean, it's gross when he turns into the bug, but I love how matter-of-fact everything is. Yeah, it's very Kafka-esque." She looks at him oddly. She laughs. "Because it's written by Franz Kafka." "Right, I mean, clearly." Yeah, so...
That's
so
good.
So that's one character who's like the epitome of pretentiousness, and you can talk about that if you want. The other one that came to mind is from Seinfeld. I don't know how versed you are in the archive of Seinfeld episodes, but there's a fairly early episode from like the second season, I think, maybe even the first. George is dating this woman who they're out on a date. I think this is like their last date at the coffee shop, and she's wearing like a kimono, and I think she's got chopsticks holding up her hair. And then she uses the phrase papier-mâché for paper mâché. And that's like where George draws the line, and he ends up calling her pretentious to her face, which precedes the beginning of the end. So,
yeah.
So those are a couple of, I read the social cues column in the New York Times, and there's a recent question that involves the word pretentious, which I can mention maybe as well. But I want to give you a chance to talk about whatever pop cultural references that come to mind for you.
Well, the one whenever I told anyone I was writing a book about pretentiousness, the one that everyone quoted back to me, and in fact I ended up using as the as one of the quotes at the start of my book, is from the British sitcom Fawlty Towers with John Cleese. And it's his wife, Sybil, on the phone, and an episode opens, you know, you're kind of eavesdropping her halfway through a conversation on the phone, and she says, she's talking to a guest called Mr. Johnson, and you hear Mr. Johnson saying, "So, Harry says, you don't like me anymore. Why not?" And he says, "Because you've got so terribly pretentious." And Harry says, "Pretentious? Moi?"
Right. Yeah, that nails it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the one that everyone reaches for. Right. Also because it does kind of, you know, it does nail a certain way in which we think about what pretentiousness is.
Yeah.
But therein, I mean, for me, just in that quote there, why is it pretentious to use a French word? You know, what is it about the sort of like Anglo-Saxon allergy to French or using another language? You know, why can't someone do that?
Yeah,
these are the questions that start coming to my mind. You know, when I look at that quote, it's very funny, but at the same time, it's like, well, but why is it funny? What is it that we're really saying about ourselves when using an English word and a French word next to each other is seen as somehow wrong?
You know, in private, in my home, I've actually taken to occasionally. You know, there's this really charming sort of thing that the Spanish do, like Rafa Nadal, the tennis player, when he's in interviews, he'll answer a question, and at the end of the answer, he'll say, "No," you know?
Yeah.
Like English, Spanish. And I've taken in private, I haven't done this in public to my knowledge, to saying, "N'est-ce pas," you know, at the end of it. Like, just because it's kind of fun, you know? I don't know if I'd want to do that in public, if I'd be brave enough to do that in public, maybe, you know, with a raised eyebrows. But yeah, I think it's very much dependent on the context, isn't it?
It's very, yeah, of course it is very context dependent, but, that still doesn't get away from the essential question. Why is it wrong? Why is it frowned upon? Why is it seen as being somehow, why is it seen as like putting on airs?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
If you do that.
Yeah, well,
I mean, one thing when I was when I was researching the book, one thing I found very interesting and illuminating to do was I googled the phrase pretentious film, and the amount of times that it comes up as a pretentious foreign film is really, really notable.
Yeah,
you know. What's pretentious about foreignness? You know, there are millions and millions of people across the world who are not of your nationality.
Right.
You know, what are these pretentious people who made this film trying to be? Swedish, French, Brazilian? You know, but they are Swedish, French, and Brazilian.
Yeah.
You know, what's so bad about taking an interest in how other people on Earth see life?
Yeah.
You know, I find that there are these sort of like little kind of gremlins of xenophobia that lurk within that kind of language, like, you know, pretentious foreign film.
Yeah, but meanwhile, I'm glad you brought that up, because film is such a perfect cultural touchstone for the word. I've listened to some pretty good film critics and cultural critics on podcasts use that word to describe films, and I tend to think I know what they're referring to, and I wish I had a specific example to use, but presuming that they're not being xenophobic, right, or being calling something pretentious because it's a foreign film, because we know they know better than that, what do you think they mean? I mean, obviously it could be many things, but from your experience hearing or reading that word in association to a film, what do you think a smart, enlightened, sophisticated critic means when they use that word?
I think they're referring to a kind of cinema that isn't conditioned by or comes from the modes of filmmaking that come out of the US. I mean, you know, you've got to remember that US films are foreign films to most of the rest of the world. I think that, you know, the kind of Hollywood film, you know, where the pace happens. You know, they happen at a certain pace. They follow, you know, very often follow very, very formulaic three-act or five-act structures or whatever, you know. There is a kind of cinema also that moves very slowly. Perhaps, you know, not a great deal happens in it. Perhaps there are no explosions. Perhaps there is no sex. Perhaps it's all about, you know, just two people in a, you know, trying to figure out their relationship in a windswept cabin on the, you know, north coast of Sweden or something, you know, which are all things to do with the way human lives happen. You know, they are representations of human life. But I think that what they're trying to say is that it's something that maybe requires a bit more of a level of, like, commitment from the viewer in order to sort of, like, stay with what's going on, because it, you know, the film might unfold very in a very, very kind of, like, slow way, or it might not push the kind of entertainment buttons that you want to get pushed. Mm. One film that I suppose would be the epitome of a pretentious foreign film would be something like Last Year at Marienbad, the Alan Resnais film, you know, which is long, it's lugubrious, it's slow-moving, it repeats itself, you know, it's got this sort of dream-like structure, and, you know, it's a brilliant movie, but it's, you know, it's not Die Hard 2 either. So, you know, right. I think that's probably what critics are referring to when they call it, okay, a film pretentious.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
But then, you know, it makes me want to ask the question, well, if it's pretentious, what's it pretending to be?
Yeah.
What is it that it is aspiring to be and somehow failing to be? Because in order to identify something as pretentious, if you identify something as pretentious, you're saying that it's aspiring to be something else and it's not being that thing. And you can clearly identify that it is not being that thing, and therefore it's a failure. But what is it that it is failing to be? Like, what, when you call Last Year at Marienbad a pretentious film, is it failing to be? What's the gold standard aspiring to be?
Yeah, I think I can actually build upon that thesis that you're making. And I haven't seen that film, so unfortunately I can't weigh in on that. But I would actually take that, the start or most of your description of that criticism, and apply it to contemporary films that, mm-hmm, whether they're American or not, but we could take certain American films as an example, that are independent, that are slow and without Hollywood standards, which is fine with me. I prefer those films by far. But I think when the critics that I was referring to level the word pretentious against the film, it's going to be a kind of film that is independent and French New Wave minded, perhaps, in a certain way. And they are going for that school of film or that sort of level of avant-gardeness, if you will. And yet they are not steeped in it themselves. So it's kind of like they've seen, you know, it's kind of the way that Jesse Eisenberg's character, you know, was talking in The Squid and the Whale. It's kind
Exactly.
It's like, I've heard about that, you know, I'm just going to kind of wing it, you know? So I think what the critics are saying most recently, when I've heard them say, yeah, the film is this, that, and it's really a kind of pretentious, is that the filmmaker is going beyond their depth. And they haven't sort of put in the time, done their homework, and they're just trying to be arty, if you will.
Mm. But then that's such a fascinating adjective, isn't it? Arty. Yeah. What do we mean?
Exactly.
You know, right? That's another word that often kind of comes, like, walks into the room in the same group as pretentious. You know, it's a bit arty.
Right.
What does that mean, and what's wrong with that? I find that a very, you know, again, that's a really fascinating use of language for me.
Right. Well,
You know, I would say that that's a really interesting argument you put there about, you know, certain type of, like, indie film, and you know, in some cases, I'm sure I would agree with you. But don't you think that also the word pretentious unconscious is a way of someone not being able to admit that they don't understand something. Like something pretentious. Things that are often described as pretentious are often very new. They're often things that are happening in the moment. They're you know, it's a new sound, it's a new artwork, it's a new, you know, way of dressing or whatever.
Right.
And quite often someone will say, oh, that's really pretentious. And that kind of, I find, like, quite often is a way of someone not being able to admit that they just don't understand something, that they don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, a much simpler way of, like, getting, a nicer way, I think, of getting through life is just to say, oh, I don't understand. I don't know. Can you explain it to me?
Right.
Whereas I think people use the word pretentious just because it's unrecognizable. It's unfamiliar. You find, I think, that the artworks, works of literature, cinema, what have you, as time progresses, as we get further and further away from their moment of inception, as they grow older and older, we become more familiar with them. We become more familiar with specific artworks, but also maybe if they've, you know, initiated a groundbreaking sort of new way of doing things, that becomes a standard, that becomes the norm. And so we get to know that is a way to make art, that is a way to make cinema, and becomes familiar. And so the thing becomes less of a threat. And you still might not like it, but it's much less likely to be described as pretentious, I think, once we're comfortable with it, than when we're in the kind of fresh moment of seeing something for the first time and we have no idea how to read it, how to take it,
right,
how to understand it.
Yeah. Yeah, I accept your model. I accept your analysis for those types of situations. I think for this, and I apologize to you and my listeners and myself for not holding on to this very particular recent example. I listened to this, there's this local show called Air Talk, and they have this film called Film Week on Fridays, and it's two or three of their regular film critics will talk about the movies that are coming out. And
yeah,
one of them issued this word pretentious about a film, and it was clearly not in a way that meant that it was, you know, too sophisticated for them. These are people that see 350 movies a year, you know. They know from films back and forth. So I'm pretty sure in this case it was more of a, you know, the filmmaker is trying to slap together some kind of gestalt and they don't know what they're doing, you know, or they're out of their element in the way that they did that part of it. But I do take your point as far as, I mean, and this is obviously an important thesis throughout your book, that it's people are afraid. They're afraid to admit that they don't know what's going on. It's too new for them, and et cetera. Meanwhile, before we get more into film, I wanted to see what comes to mind for you for art and pretentiousness. I know you wrote quite a bit about it in terms of the UK art scene or the museum scene, but what about, since you've been in the States and New York, what comes to mind for you are examples of pretentiousness being hurled at art by critics or otherwise?
In the US?
Yeah.
Or anywhere?
Yeah, well, by US people. Anyway,
I think in the US, you know, you find that quite often the same things are regarded as pretentious here as they are in the UK.
Well, I mean, just let me just interject for just a second.
Contemporary art.
Let me just interject for a second, because I think from what you wrote about some instances from the UK press, they square with my experience of it. First of all, the UK press, there seems to be a lot more writing about art per capita in the UK than there is here. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And it seems also that there is more of a conservative streak in art criticism or art writing there than there is here. So how do you square that with, you know, the way that the P word pretentious gets hurled at art in New York, say?
I think in New York there is, and there has been for a long time, maybe a little bit more of a kind of a greater acceptance of like modern and contemporary art, because in this city in particular, it's very much kind of wound into New York's image of itself and its history, and its 20th century history, and you know, in its time as the, you know, the preeminent modern city of the world. So you know, if you think about modern art post-war, and you know, as the old sort of like cliche goes, you know, Paris kind of lost its status after World War II as the place where all the innovations were being made, and it shifted over the Atlantic to New York. And you know, you think about abstract expressionism and all those, you know, those like ABEX, gestural painters. You know, that's a, we associate that in the popular imaginary also with New York, and then a bit later after that, you know, with Warhol and Oldenburg and Jasper Johns and you know, all kinds of like neo-expressionists and then proto-pop artists and pop artists, Lichtenstein. You know, again, it's very New York. Especially Warhol, we, you know, he's so much part of like our idea of the mythos of New York. And you know, going forward beyond that into, you know, we think about, you know, painting in the 1980s, and it's like Clemente and Schnabel and Basquiat and, you know, dudes with far too much money painting in expensive suits in Soho. You know, it's part of like the pop cultural imaginary of New York. So I think that, you know, I think that people in New York, when they're told that there's like a big show on at the Met or MoMA that they should go and see, people will go and see it. You know, it's almost like part of your civic duty is to be, to be informed about these things. Whether or not you like it is another matter entirely. And, you know, New Yorkers are wonderfully opinionated about that, and they will not shy away from telling you their opinion.
Right.
Whereas I think in say a city like London, of course, you know, Tate Modern, when it opened in 2000, really, really was quite a kind of institutional game changer, and it became this massive tourist attraction. The idea of like modern and contemporary art, again, people are suspicious of it, but it's more of a, you know, it's certainly something people accept happens, and might go and, you know, if they're feeling curious, they might go to the Tate Modern or some such museum and see what people are up, see what's up. I think in Britain, historically, you have two things. You have much more, it's much more of a literary country. It's a literary culture. There's an art historian, Andrew Graham Dixon, who I remember reading something he wrote about how the Reformation, the English Reformation, when the churches and abbeys up and down the country were smashed and looted of any kind of graven image, really, really was a sort of massive psychological trauma moment in British kind of culture in terms of its relationship to images. And after that, you know, a lot more effort was put into literary culture or musical culture. And I think that people are a bit more kind of open to the idea of literature, of books and music being something they're comfortable with experimentation in or the new, especially pop music. You know, that's such a kind of vehicle for strangeness and new ideas, you know, in the late 20th century in Britain, that people were kind of felt like they could be part of, they could take part in it, they could enjoy it themselves. Whereas I think like British attitudes to modern contemporary art have been very, very skeptical, very, very suspicious.
Right.
Things started to change in the 1990s when you had the rise of, I suppose, you know, these sort of the media phenomenon of like young British artists. And then at the end of the 90s and 2000, the opening of Tate Modern, people are much more used to talking about it now. But I think that there is definitely a very deeply embedded skepticism towards art in Britain.
Well, let's underscore that through your book. So why don't we get another reading in? And this is the one that's on page, my version, page 93. It's Contemporary Art Causes Rivers of Bilious Prose, that one?
All right.
Okay, so this is from page 93 of the American version.
Yeah, okay. Contemporary art causes rivers of bilious prose to spring in the media. In an article for the Observer newspaper, published on 26th of November 2000, the political broadcaster Andrew Marr described a couple visiting the Tate's annual Turner Prize for Contemporary Art. Quote, they are in their 20s, probably lovers, certainly unmarried. He wears a thin grey jersey, and leather trousers, with carefully maintained stubble and wraparound shades, despite the dim light. She is Japanese, dressed in a bright plastic jacket, child colors, unsmiling, unquote. Ma writes about how they are part of, quote, a modern tribe, a vast nomadic group, mostly young, urban, clever, a little intimidating, given to expensive hodden clothes and rimless glasses. They seem poised. They treasure silence. I am talking, obviously, of the followers of contemporary art, unquote. He signed off his article with this thought. That couple I started with, the cool ones, I hate them. It is time to elbow them aside and fill up the galleries with the rest of us. The musician Nick Curry, who goes under the name Momus, recognized himself in Ma's article. Writing on his website, Curry explained, "At first I'm merely amused to recognize myself and my colorful, childlike Japanese girlfriend in this caricature of the gallery going public. But the more I think about it, the more disturbed I get that this sort of thing, an unashamed and blatantly expressed hatred of sophistication, is what passes in the UK for cultural coverage." For Ma to say of two museum visitors he's never met, "I hate them," is cheap, them versus us populism. But it speaks to an ugly intolerance for difference, to an expectation that people must share the same aesthetic tastes and appearances, and that if they don't, they must be complicit members of an elitist racket hell-bent on excluding so-called ordinary people from its world. Those ordinary people who it is assumed could not possibly be interested in complex ideas and conversant in different forms of visual literacy.
Yeah. So a couple quick questions that come to mind. One is, so this is from 2000, and it obviously supports my perception and yours about the British press having a conservative streak. So we're 18 years beyond that now. How much has that landscape, to your knowledge, changed? Or do you still, to what extent is there still a retroactive presence in the British art press?
It's softened a bit, but it's still there. You can identify certain critics.
They're representing the Brexit crowd, perhaps?
No, not even that, really. I think it's a certain type of British newspaper journalist, newspaper critic who is of a certain age, perhaps, you know, getting into middle age, and they feel like they've been, you know, on top of the game in terms of, you know, their understanding of culture for a long time, and it sort of slipped away from them. And this is sort of their way of venting a certain frustration at that.
Right.
But that's my opinion. And also, it's just like contemporary art. It's a very easy target in certain ways. It writes its own copy in a way sometimes.
Yeah,
for better or for worse.
But can you imagine, though? I mean, has there even ever been a case, to your knowledge, in the New York or in the States generally, where an art writer, art journalist, what have you, has written about art goers in such detail and clear contempt?
You've got me there. I'm sure there must have been. You know, I'm sure there must have been, you know, some ultra-conservative critic writing in the Times at a certain point, you know, who's made that observation. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head.
Okay, well, let me jump in with actually one that we can dismiss or we can pick into its potential relevance, and that is, it's not the same thing, but as you may be aware, there's been a lot of spectacle art shows going on of late. I don't know how many in New York, but certainly here in LA and elsewhere in the country, particularly the Yayoi Kusama Infinity Rooms, right? But there have been other exhibitions, like pop-up exhibitions and what have you, that have been going on that are very sort of selfie-based or selfie-oriented. And while I don't know how much writers have written specifically about art goers, museum goers, what have you, they have written about, including Hyperallergic in particular, the throngs of lines waiting to get into these shows. So it's kind of more of a mass judgment, you know, look at these people waiting for hours in line to get their selfies kind of thing, which I can actually get behind. And I don't know if I'm aligning myself with this this British journalist or not, but I don't know. What do you think?
I don't see what's wrong with people queuing up to do that. If that's the, you know, I mean, complicated, isn't it? Our relationship now to how we consume culture and represent ourselves within it, and you know, the making of our own and distribution of our own images via phones and social media and so on. If someone wants to queue up for hours to see Yayoi Kusama and take a photograph of themselves in it, then what's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with it. I guess I misrepresented my take on it. It's not that there's something wrong with it per se, if that's something they want to do. It's just, how do I want to put this? I guess it's just, it's kind of a, I think the implication is a little bit sad that there are a lot of cultural things, there are a lot of great ways to consume art and culture, and to sort of do the equivalent of going to Disneyland is maybe not the highest on people's, shouldn't be the highest on people's list, I guess. Does that make sense?
Wait, are you referring to the Kusama as being a bit like Disneyland, or do you mean the act of queuing up and taking a selfie in a Kusama?
Yeah, the latter.
The latter?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's really probably... I mean, firstly, you don't know what people are thinking. You don't know what any of those people in that line are thinking and what their relationship is to that experience and to taking a selfie in there. Secondly, not everyone is taking a selfie in there. It's like a gross generalization. Thirdly, you don't know what they're doing with that image. You know, you don't know like what they might personally be getting out of that image or the experience of being in there. You know, you can't... you know, there's one form of language that you get a lot in the art press that drives me nuts, which, and you know, you find it on wall texts and press releases too, you know, from museums and galleries, you know, which is about challenging, you know, the audience assumptions or challenging audience preconceptions. You don't know what my preconceptions are. You don't know what my assumptions are.
Right.
So stop pretending that you can, that you're in some sort of position of like greater knowledge about my psychological, you know, about my psychological, you know, condition, about my inner life. And I think that I feel a bit the same about this case. You know, we don't know what people are doing with these images. And frankly, it's probably, you know, the phone is and the selfie and everything is an activity that's an activity that's built onto the ways in which people consumed culture for decades anyway. There's probably, you know, lots of people would go to the museum on a wet Sunday afternoon in the pre-internet days and stand around bored and, you know, wish they could be looking at the postcards. And, you know, it's just, it, you know, just taking a selfie is just like another kind of form of entertainment or activity that people who might or might not have an interest in what they're seeing would do anyway.
I wonder if the subtext of what you're saying is that it's better to have engagement of some kind than none at all, or if there's something that if there's an element to it such as a selfie that can get people engaged, then that's a good thing across
fine.
The board.
It's totally fine. You know, there are different ways to engage with culture, and we don't all have to you know, we don't all have to file into the museum like penitent monks and stand there in front of the great Rothko and gaze at it until we have communed with the great cosmic otherness and really understood something very serious and scholarly about this experience. We don't have to. Not everyone wants to do that. Not everyone is capable of doing that. And not everyone should do it all the time. There are different registers for talking about and consuming culture. And I think we need to be very, very careful about the assumptions that we make about people and their capacity, their capacity for understanding complex ideas, which is often much greater than critics who would poo-poo people taking selfies might think. And, you know, this takes us back to, you know, the Andrew Marr comment about, you know, we must get these, what is it, you know, we must elbow them aside and fill up the galleries with the rest of us. You know, who are these ordinary people, and why might they? I mean, they might be interested in something complex and strange and disquieting, and, you know, who knows?
Right. Okay. Well, so are you speaking hypothetically, or do you have any actual experience talking to the people that we're sort of referring to?
Well, I always liked to quote quote something a friend of mine said to me once, an artist friend of mine said to me once, which is the first thing that he asks himself when he's made a new piece of art is, can I explain this to my parents?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think about my mum and dad, and neither of them have an art education. Neither of them, you know, are people who have, who are very kind of literate in contemporary art or modern art. And sometimes, you know, I've dragged them to a museum or in my teenage days, my mum, bless her, would take me to, you know, a modern art exhibition up in London, because I was showing an interest in this kind of thing. And they often don't understand it. They often don't, you know, quote unquote, get what it is we're supposed to be looking at. But we can often have really good conversations about it too. They can see things in there sometimes that I might not pick up on, or I might be so, you know, my head might be so filled up with, you know, all the sort of like highfalutin, you know, art historical references that I can identify in a particular sculpture that I don't notice the bleeding obvious sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean,
you know, so that's an example from, you know, that's an example, you know, close to home. And, I'm not saying my parents are representative of, you know, the ordinary, you know, man and woman on the street either. But, I think you can have conversations with people about things, and they're often very surprising.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that in my earlier description that I wasn't being dismissive or skeptical of art viewers who are not sort of in the know, sophisticated, you know, part of the team or the tribe. That's not at all the case. I think this selfie thing is something else. And I know people who work at the Broad here in Los Angeles. And from what I've heard, it sounds like it's gotten to the point where it's a paradigm change, and not in a good way. You know, the way that people sort of are all over each other, you know, posing in front of works, you know, and I understand maybe that your sort of counter argument is that you know, we don't know what they're thinking, and it's engagement, you know, maybe this is their way of engaging, and, you know, it's a foot in the door or what have you. But I don't know. It definitely rubs me the wrong way. And if you feel differently,
well, ask yourself this: how would you like people to behave? What is it that you feel is missing?
Yeah.
Like what kind of level of decorum or engagement or behavior in the museum do you think is not happening and that you wish for?
I think in that case, it's that they're actually experiencing the art as opposed to experiencing being photographed in front of the art.
Say that isn't an experience of the art?
It is.
How is that not an experience of the art? I mean, it is a human body in a gallery with a work of art.
Right.
And their engagement with it is mediated by this device in their hands, certainly.
Yeah.
That is an unusual new thing in our culture. But who is to say that is not an experience of the art?
I'm not saying it's not an experience of the art. It's just it feels like a heavily mediated one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. I mean, that's true. But it's still an experience of the art.
Right.
I mean, it's still a form of engagement. I'm sorry, I'm playing devil's advocate a bit here.
Yeah, no, you're doing a great job. Actually, I'm like fully like I'm back up against the wall. And I guess is that for argument's sake, or do you? I mean, is this something you've written about at all, or, you know, to what extent? Yeah, what's your horse in the game here?
Well, that's a great question. I think my horse in the game is a confused horse. It's a poor old nag that doesn't know which way to run.
Right, right.
And so, you know, I'm interested in both, you know, both sides of it there. I know that's a very equivocating answer to give, but
no, I think it's it's a good.
I'm quite interested to sort of press down on the issue, you know, in both, you know, on both sides of the argument.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the tone of your book is too. You know, it's that you're saying, let's keep our minds open. You know, that's what the pretentiousness as a word becomes an entry point to give things a second look and not to be so dismissive. That's just one, you know, that's just one element of it. But that's, that's a, you know, how that dovetails with your book. Where would you, is there anywhere in particular you'd like to go? I was thinking, there's so many interesting quotes about the art world, that we should definitely get to at least one of them. But as we were talking about the whole selfie thing, I was thinking about this artist that you wrote about, going back much earlier in the book, and I wonder if you want to go there as opposed to one of those other places.
Which artist?
Tyler Rowland.
Oh, Tyler. Yeah, what is it you want to talk about in terms of...
Well, I just think, first of all, I wasn't at all familiar with him and his project, so I think it would be interesting to introduce him to listeners. So...
Yeah, this is a New York-based artist called Tyler Rowland, and a project he did between 2002 and 2015. And during that time, he conducted a 13-year experiment in living called Artist Uniform, for which he adopted an eclectic array of appearances or personae for a given period of time. He became the artist Gustave Courbet for 3 months, wearing a beard, frock coat, beret, drinking heavily, and regularly visiting his retrospective exhibition that was then on at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. For 1 year, he wore only clothes bought for him by friends, and for another 12-month period, dressed as a zebra, sporting a Mohican and wearing black and white striped clothing. The project began with Artist Uniform Number 1, The Year I Dyed All My Clothes Pink. Rowland described the extreme reactions he would get on the street, dressed head to toe in pink. I bet a woman made you do it. Fucking homo. You are the coolest person I've ever met. Rowland, who had always enjoyed dressing up since childhood, and so did not consider it to be out of character to pursue the project, was interested in how clothing keeps a person in character, in how a uniform, as opposed to a costume, signaled a vocation or commitment on the part of the person wearing the clothes.
Did you know Tyler before he started this project? Did you find out? I presume you found out about him at some point during.
Yeah, I mean, I moved to New York in 2009, so he was already 7 years into the project.
Right.
I didn't meet him until a couple of years after that, even.
And how well so known?
I didn't know him before he began it.
And how well? How widely known was this project that he was doing?
Not at all.
How did you find out about it?
Sorry, Tyler, if you're listening to this.
How did he find out about it?
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a well-known project, and it came to its conclusion in 2015 with a really small, kind of wonderful little show documenting the entire project in his apartment on the Lower East Side in Manhattan.
Mm. Okay.
It wasn't a project that was attracting huge amounts of publicity.
Right.
It wasn't a project that was that had art dealers, you know, knocking on the door trying to, you know, get a piece of him. Or, you know, it wasn't a project that got him huge museum shows or anything like that. It was just a really, really committed way of living for 13 years.
Yeah, it reminds me of a number of sort of vintage or original performance art pieces, you know, from back in the day.
Yeah, like
New York.
Like Tse Ching Hei.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But to what extent was he documenting it in such a way to sort of get the word out, or was it more I'm just going to do this and, you know, and then I'll document it when it's over kind of thing?
I mean, he documented it along the way. As far as like getting it out there, I don't really. That's a very good question. I don't know. You know, there's also, you know, in 13 years, a lot happens to a person in their lives.
Right.
So I think there were times when, you know, he was able to sort of concentrate on, like, thinking about the documenting the form of it and, you know, how to present it to the world after the fact. And then there are other times when just, you know, life. He had to get on with living life. And so, you know, he would wear the pink clothes or dress as a zebra, but, you know, still had to get up and go to work every day.
Did you get to accompany him?
You know, there isn't necessarily time to be thinking about being in the art project all the time when you're doing that.
Did you get to accompany him on one of his sojourns as in a character or costume?
No, I didn't. But I've heard, you know, I heard lots and lots of stories from him about about the project, and that was during the course of thinking about writing this book, and somehow a lot of it stayed in my mind, especially the things that he told me about the idea of dressing up being something that he liked to do, and it was just part of his character. So it was not out of character for him to dress up, and yet the way strangers perceived him, it was seen as somehow an affront to them, or a total inspiration. And that somehow made me, that seemed to strike a chord with me and seemed to resonate with certain lines of thought that I was following in writing the book.
Yeah, right. I'm just going to direct you now to, because there are a few more quotes that I thought we really should get to. So this is back later in the book where you define pretentiousness in terms of the art world again.
We smell pretentiousness when we believe something is trying to stay out of reach from us. When we suspect someone is trying to put a red velvet rope and bouncer in our way. Because stories about Russian oligarchs and what they do with their money make better copy for media outlets than narratives about artists trying to eke a living, the art world is broadly perceived as a playground for the super rich. The wider picture of its demographic makeup, the one that includes technicians, fabricators, scholars, social outreach and education workers, students, arts journalists, museum guards, all struggling to make a living wage, all people Andrew Marr would describe as the rest of us, is occluded by the small percentage of the art world that make money from it. Yet money is a topic that everyone can understand. It might be tacky to talk about it, but it's a convenient way into the conversation around art. Artists themselves are hard to place socially. Intellectualism and creativity in the arts and humanities is a space of self-construction. Artists, quote, have an unusual amount of say over the content of their own creative output, argues critic Ben Davis. Personal fulfillment and professional ambition overlap, the classic middle-class aspiration. Archetypes of self-definition, artists are not necessarily materially wealthy, but appear to have freedom and move in high-class circles. They make things, but often those things are unique objects that sell for high prices, or unusual in form and content, and require imagination and effort in order to understand them. It was Diana Trilling who said, "All artists are snobs, whatever the social group with which they make common cause, if only to the extent that they live by discriminations." Positioning of identity in the art world is a multidimensional game of chess in which the object is to play simultaneously above, below, central, and to one side of the action, and to learn when to accentuate one position more than another. In 1977, critic and art historian Lucy Lippard wrote The Pink Glass Swan, a blistering essay attacking the class myopia of the art world. In one passage, she describes how artists are, quote, persistently working up to be accepted, not only by other artists, but also by the hierarchy that exhibits, writes about, and buys her or his work. But at the same time, she or he is often ideologically working down in an attempt to identify with the workers outside of the art context. Middle-class artists sometimes display a touch of adolescent rebellion against authority. Those few who have actually emerged from the working class sometimes use their very lack of background privilege as privilege in itself, while playing the same schizophrenic foreground role as their solidly middle-class colleagues.
I feel like we could have just used this one page had that been the foundation of the whole conversation, hour-and-a-half conversation, potentially. Let me know if there's something particularly that strikes you after having read that. I think one thing that I would want to get to is, well, one of the things that was coming to mind as you were reading it is as you were describing artists, which you do elsewhere as well, and sort of what their universe is like, what their ecosystem is like. I was thinking about you and to what extent you would identify yourself sort of as part of that milieu, you know, because obviously I presume you hang around a number of artists. Do you feel like you could describe yourself the same way in terms of not being materially wealthy, but being, you know, wealthy with the aura and the intellectual stimulation and so on that comes from that experience? How would you characterize yourself as like an artist in those ways, and how might you characterize yourself as different?
Well, as someone I know once put it, you know, the I think we describe ourselves as critics as poverty jet set. You know, it's this sort of strange world in which, you know, certainly as a writer, you're the bottom of the heap, or not quite the bottom of the heap, but fairly low down the ladder in terms of remuneration for what you do. Just as many artists are actually far down the ladder of remuneration, for their efforts. I've been very, very lucky in that I've had a steady job, a steady wage, working as an editor for an art magazine for a long time, which a lot of freelance writers don't have. You know, it's a very precarious existence they have. But even working as an editor for Frieze, contrary to what people might assume, I don't earn a great deal of money, and it's not a career that is particularly well paid. But at the same time, I'm able to travel. I've found myself in extraordinary places, talking to extraordinary people, and been very, very lucky to have access to exhibitions and museums and so on. So, you know, there is this sort of strange schizophrenia. I use that word glibly. there's a strange sort of experience that you have where, you know, you do sort of get to glimpse behind the curtain at, you know, the high life. You get to have a look at, you know, you get to be in a room with, you know, vastly wealthy people, it's not actually anything I can sort of share in. You know, I can't afford to buy a work of art. I've never bought a work of art. All the artwork I own has been given to me by friends or traded with friends for a piece of writing.
Like, have you written somebody's catalog, say, for a piece of their work? That kind of thing?
Never a museum catalog or anything kind of official like that. In those cases, I always ask to be, you know, I want to be paid money.
Well, what writing?
I've got to eat and you know, pay the rent. But sometimes that artist friends who have been making, say, like a small little, you know, hand-bound screen printed little publication or one instance recently, a friend who also runs a record label was putting out a record and wanted me to write a sleeve note for it. So I did that in exchange for a piece of work. That felt like a really nice exchange.
Right. And have there not been situations where you might have been able to buy a low priced work, you know, in an emerging gallery or artist context?
I've never bought anything from a gallery, because I think that puts me in an awkward relationship.
Right. So you're a purist in that sense.
You know, I mean, that sort of sounds a bit old fashioned perhaps, but I know that there are critics who do buy works from galleries, and I wouldn't do it myself, but I also, you know, they've got their own, you know, ethics around that they adhere to, and that's fine. For me, it makes me feel slightly uncomfortable.
Right. I see. But you do get to, as you said, travel. So does your work take you then elsewhere in the country and abroad?
Yeah. When I was living in London, I traveled a lot in Europe, around Europe, of course. And then since I moved to New York, I've traveled a great deal around the US, Canada, and Latin America, and South America.
That's not a bad gig.
It's not a bad gig. It's a pretty large, you know, beat to have. It's been tremendously enriching, and I feel very lucky to have been able to do that.
Yeah, that's great. I really wanted you to read the one where you describe sort of the different types of artists, because I thought that was really spot on, and I think it's the next one. I'm just double checking. So this is just a little bit after where you were. And it's something, it sort of speaks to the different reasons behind why artists stay in art, for among other things.
Accusations of elitism circle above the art world in a perpetual holding pattern. Here the word elite never means highly trained or of exceptional quality. Instead, it gets used as a synonym for intellectual, urban, rich, wielded in much the same way that the word pretentious is. The art world incubates many subcultures. Some are in it for shits and giggles, others because it is a vocation, a life they'll never make money from, but which sustains them in deep creative ways. Some enter for scholarly reasons, others to do business, or because they enjoy playing its politics. Within it, there is as much collegiality and internecine bickering as within any other subculture, and the assumption that it can be grouped together as one homogenous group is shaky at best. The apparent difficulty of contemporary art suggests that it requires a specialist education in order to understand, that it demands time for study that only the privileged can afford to spend. Therefore, it's art made for cliques, not crowds. Artworks can certainly be opaque. I've been an art critic since 1999 and still find many artworks hard to fathom. But for me, therein also lies the fun, the pleasure of figuring out a puzzle or piecing together a backstory, or simply applying your imagination to your own reading of whatever painting or sculpture you're looking at. There is no wrong way to look at art, only schools of thought, some of which the artist might support, that suggest a particular way of looking or arise from a feeling of duty to be true to what the artist says their work is about.
Yeah, I particularly was drawn to the way that you categorized so succinctly the ways that artists and or people in the art world are in it, you know, are in the game. I really love the shits and giggles. that was great. So what do I want to ask you about that? I think one of the questions that came to mind as you were reading that is, I know it's hard, it's impossible to break down, you know, the percentages, but it's something that I've talked about on the show before, you know, how many artists are actually making a living. And even as you point out, you know, in this art world, there are artists that are making a living and then there are artists that are making a living, you know, as in, you know, there are some artists that are just business people, you know, like who are, they don't care about how good or serious their work is. But all that said,
or indeed, know, some who are making a really, really good living really do care about that. Being very, very kind of like rich and successful does not necessarily mean that you don't care about what you're doing.
Oh yeah, no, of course. But how many people? Let's just put it this way: what percentage of the people in the art world, if you were to, you know, be pushed on the matter, would you say can sustain themselves on their work alone?
Ah, God, that's a really good question. I base a lot of it on the people I know.
It's all anecdotal, of course.
Yeah, it's all anecdotal, and, you know, I would say it's a small percentage. If we're talking about artists, you know, and work they make, I would say it's a pretty small percentage. Maybe, I don't know.
Do you want to say more than or less than 10%?
Maybe 10%.
Okay.
So many people I know have other jobs as teachers, technicians, other kinds of day jobs. They don't necessarily make that many sales.
Yeah.
Sometimes they work for other artists as assistants or studio managers.
Right.
They'll you know, it's very boom and bust, you know, they might hit upon a spell when they sold a bit of work, and that's great. They can pay off some debts. They can not worry for a little while, and then they'll have a real dry spell and not sell anything at all.
Yeah.
And even in that dry spell, you know, maybe they're getting museum shows, or they're being, you know, they get included in, you know, big fancy biennials. But those museum shows and those biennials don't pay a great deal of money, contrary to what people might assume.
Mm.
I mean, if you look at the work of a group here in New York called Working Artists for the Greater Economy, WAGE, you know, they did an incredible audit of all the nonprofit institutions and museums in New York, asking them what fees they pay artists for doing shows, and it's shocking. It's shocking how there is no minimum wage for artists. There's no minimum standard for what artists get paid. Some museums of repute don't even pay artists to do shows, you know, the assumption being, well, you know, it's the exposure is what's important.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, appearances, I mean, it's the art world is a world of appearances. It concerns mm-hmm. itself with surfaces a lot, and mm-hmm. that includes the ways in which we perceive each other professionally. And I think that those surfaces can be deceptive. Someone you might assume has a very, very successful career in critical terms, in institutional terms, they might not be doing so well financially.
Right. Yeah, I think Ellen Harvey and I talked about that as well, you know, that there are a lot of, or maybe it was another artist. In any case, we talked about the smoke and mirrors, or the, you know, the facade of success that was, yeah. you know, hid Jennifer Dalton. That's who it was. We talked about that. Do you think, speaking of the sentiment, the art world incubates many subcultures, others because it is a vocation, a life they'll never make money from, but which sustains them in deep creative ways. How much of that sentiment informed your moving towards writing and editing as opposed to becoming an artist, or was it much more random than that?
Are you asking whether writing and editing is a vocation for me?
No. What I'm asking is, you actually got into a part of the art world where you can make a living. You know, do you think you got out of being an artist because of that?
It was twofold, really. Firstly, it was purely, you know, on a purely practical level, I need to make, you know, money, make rent. I don't come from a background of, you know, a trust fund or anything like that. So, you know, I've got to have a job like everyone else does. Secondly, I started writing and editing around about the same time that I hit a bit of an impasse, hit a bit of a brick wall in terms of making art myself, mm-hmm. which is in a long time ago, in 1999, 2000. And when I started writing, it seemed to provide some sort of relief for me in a way. It would seem to be much more interesting to me to look at what other people are doing, think about what other people are doing, rather than make anything myself. And I didn't feel like I could make anything myself. I felt stuck. Mm-hmm. And so I put art making aside for a while. And then over the years, I've gradually found my way back to it, but not really in a way that I expected. I mean, certain energies that I had for making art went into running a record label and playing music, which I've done a lot of the last 20 years. You know, with writing, I was learning on the job, learning criticism on the job, essentially. But at the same time, I was being offered opportunities through artists making a little publication for which they wanted an experimental piece of fiction, and they'd ask me to do it. Mm. And I'd have these opportunities to write weirder things that would be read by, you know, like three people or whatever. But there were opportunities to sort of spread my wings a bit in terms of writing. Mm-hmm. I also, you know, I helped artist friends work on scripts for performances or videos. I worked on a project with the artist group Dexter Sinister to make a sort of audio essay for them, which ended up turning into a strange kind of performance lecture, which then turned into a spoken word record, you know, with a sort of essay illustrated by music and various other sort of like sonic illustrations. And I feel that writing has sort of brought me back into a form of art making, but it's just not, it doesn't really look like art. it's something in the, you know, that exists in a funny sort of like nether world somewhere between criticism and fiction and essay writing and so on.
What's so great about writing is it takes up so little space when it comes to storage.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. It's not very messy, which is good. You don't have to tidy up afterwards, only right. Psychologically.
Yeah. One of the subtext, and this has come up before in some forms as well, and I want to push you on it a little bit, when you were talking about that you needed a job, you know, that to pay the rent, you know, you didn't have a trust fund. And I've heard that sentiment expressed before. Being that, you know, we did talk about, I tried to pin you down on what percentage of people make a living from the work. What percentage of people, you know, and this is completely hypothetical or completely an estimate, you know, a rough estimate and anecdotal, but how many people do you think do fit that description of, you know, having a trust fund? I mean, and of course, there's a spectrum of how much the trust fund supports the individual, but, you know, you do sort of subtextually point to that part of the population in your writing there.
Yeah, I mean, you should take what I'm saying with a bit of a grain of salt. Again, because, you know, we don't know what someone's, like, you know, private financial arrangements are.
Sure.
I think that, so I don't, you know, I don't want to make a guesstimate of, you know, how many rich kids there are in the art world. because people work out, you know, people have all kinds of workarounds for themselves. I would say, speaking generally, that I do think there are class barriers in the art world in the UK and in the US.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
You can't live in a city like New York and do an unpaid internship,
right,
and not have a day job.
Yeah,
unless you've got some sort of independent wealth. And
yeah,
I think that is a threshold that a lot of people can't reach. And, you know, the only way to get a job in the art world is to have some experience. And how do you get that experience? Well, you've got to do an internship. And how do you afford to do an internship if you can't sustain yourself through some sort of other means?
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that, you know, there are these forms of, like, there are these class barriers that exist and which aren't talked about enough.
Yeah, and the reason that you didn't even want to make a hypothetical guess is because this is one of the last great secrets, you know. This is something that people don't want to talk about, and for, you know, for understandable reasons, you know.
Of course,
you don't want that label pegged on you, you know?
Of course. And, you know, you've got, we have to also remember that, you know, just because someone is, you know, financially privileged doesn't mean they're also not intelligent or creative or
right,
imaginative.
Yeah,
you know, there is a form of inverted snobbery, which assumes that the person from lower, you know, kind of lesser means has more access to, you know, authentic reserves of authenticity and expression that someone who comes from a more comfy background doesn't have. You know, that's not true.
Right. Parenthetically, I want to ask you, have you seen this movie that's popped up on Netflix recently? I think it's called Blurred Barriers or Blurry Lines or something like that, about the art world.
Oh, Christ, I saw the trailer for it, and I'm not sure I can bring myself to watch it.
I am exactly...
It looks appalling.
I am on exactly the same page. The image, the cover image that comes up is a shot of Schnabel, so that's an immediate non-starter for me. But apart from that, you know, tell me if this makes sense at all, but watching movies or television, especially documentaries about the art world, I mean, apart from, like, Art 21 and what have you, it feels like a weird kind of homework that, you know, and I know it's one shouldn't be so fragile or sensitive about how the sausage gets made, but sometimes that stuff is just unpleasant to watch in video form.
I think that my problem with it is that it only describes one aspect of the art world.
Mm.
You know, these shows, they always focus on big auction houses and big marquee name artists,
yeah,
with huge studios, and
right,
they focus on, like, the big blue chip galleries, and it's all about, like, the international jet set world of art that we see,
yeah,
you know, represented a lot in the media. But, you know, there's never a show about an artist that's juggling two jobs and,
yeah, right,
and trying to pay their rent for a shitty little studio in Bushwick.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a story that the bodies that commission these kinds of documentaries really, really want to tell.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I always thought that that Sarah Thornton book, 7 Days in the Art World, should have been renamed 7 Days in an Art World.
Brilliant. I will tell Sarah that if she ever returns any of my emails again.
Maybe don't mention my name. I wrote that once.
No. I don't think
she cared for that comment.
yeah. No, don't worry. I won't mention your name. But so writing and editing for Freeze, as you have since 99, right? So a good nearly 20 years. To what extent do you now and over the years, have you had the agency to cover those other art worlds, you know, the people with the day jobs or cover shows, you know, cause you write about shows, I'm sure, that are under the radar, as it were, that are not along the beaten track.
I've had tremendous amounts of agency to do that. I think Freeze is very, you know, it's always been really open to covering under the radar spaces and emerging artists and being one of the people that commissions reviews, I would often commission myself to do that. You know, I give agency, not just to myself, but to lots of other critics to cover that kind of work. You know, I think the remit of an art magazine such as Freeze is to provide, you know, a big overview of what's going on. And so, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you do want to talk about like what the really big show at MoMA is that everyone is talking about, you know, who is like, what's the take on, I don't know, Pacific Standard Time or something like that, in LA where, you know, everyone's talking about it. Because it becomes a bit exhausting often to just read about obscure names you've never heard of in tiny spaces you've never been to. But it's also important to pay attention to those too. So, you know, I feel that over the years that I've kind of covered the whole sort of range of it personally as a writer, and have very much enjoyed that. You know, I've enjoyed seeing how artists' careers, you know, careers have developed, you know, whose work I might have encountered in a tiny group show in an artist-run space somewhere, you know, and who are now, you know, enjoying a successful career. You know, it's gratifying and interesting to see to see how people's work changes over the years.
Yeah, and speaking of that, are you cognizant of when you choose to write about a show, in certain cases, that review or that article might be provide a significant boost to that artist? You know, I don't know to what degree Freeze's platform plays in that way, but it's something that I've talked about with people on this show a number of times is the critical review validation formula.
It's particularly the case to artists. Yeah. I think critics have a they have a responsibility when they write anything. What they are writing is going to affect someone else's life.
Yeah,
you might not be cognizant of it because, you know, often you publish a review and you never hear anything. You never hear anything from the gallery or the artist or anything like that. You know, it's sometimes it feels like it's just sort of drifting off in the wind and there's, you know, tumbleweed blowing around you know, the review. But, you know, sometimes you do get feedback and you realize that it has made a difference to someone or to a particular gallery. It's certainly the case, you know, if you ever write anything that's more negatively critical, people get very upset.
Yeah.
Understandably so, and you should only do that, you know, with a sense of the responsibility of what it is that you're doing, if you're going to wield your words in those ways.
Yeah.
Because they do affect people's lives.
Yeah, I'm glad you recognize that because that's something that has become ever more clear to me over the years.
They affect people's lives psychologically as well as
I mean it's right
professional terms. You know, if you've ever sat with a friend who's an artist or creative of any kind, you know, creative person of any kind, and you've sat with them and they've read a review of something they've done, be it an exhibition, a book, a record, and it's not been a particularly positive review, you know, to see how upset that person can become is really, you know, it's really something. It really, really rams it home. You know, I tell this story sometimes to people about how years ago, in when I was living in London, I wrote a review of a show by a artist duo who go under the name Art Lab, and it was a pretty vociferous review. And I think looking back now, whilst I agree generally with the points that I made about it, about the merits of the show, I think I should have tempered my language a little. But I wrote this, you know, swashbuckling negative review, and felt all kind of, you know, pleased with myself about it. And then 2 days after it came out, I went to an opening, and it was on a nice summery evening, and it was down a little street in London where there's no traffic, so people were spilling out of the gallery onto the street, drinking beer, chatting, you know, all that. And I was walking along and, you know, looking forward to going to see the show and seeing my friends. And then it was like being in like an old-fashioned Western movie, as if like out of nowhere, both of those artists just stepped into the middle of the road,
right,
and faced me down and shouted at me like they really tore a strip off me in front of all these people. And you know, they were justifiably upset, and you know, I held my ground. I still, you know, held to what I said, but I also had to just take it on the chin. You know, they had a right to reply, and you know, that's when you realize that the critic's life is one that involves responsibility, and it's also not necessarily a life in which you make friends. You can alienate yourself from the community, whatever that community is, as well, with what you do. And that's part of, that can be part of, you know, what being a critic is.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the covering, if you have a finite amount of things that you're going to cover, that you cover things that you generally are going to be favorable towards, as opposed to things that you're not, which by writing about them at all, you know, you're giving them attention. You know, that's something I've talked about with a couple of people. And sort of to sort of contextualize that a bit more, you know, there's the idea of covering shows that everybody's covering because you want to be one of the people who weighs in on it with their own opinion, you know, sort of on the other side of that scale, if you will.
Sorry, what's the question?
Well, the question is, based on what you just said with that anecdote, what is your approach? In other words, will you write about anything that you want to write about? To what extent do you take in consideration, well, I mean, I don't like this show, but on the other hand, by writing about it, I'm just going to give it attention and I'd rather just fade away?
It depends, really. It's a real case-by-case thing. I think sometimes, you know, there is a show that happens and someone needs to stand up and say something.
Yeah.
You know, if it's maybe symptomatic of a broader pattern of something unpleasant that's going on, and, you know, in the galleries or museums or whatever, and someone needs to just say something, like call it out. Sometimes, yes, it is just better to ignore a show, especially if it's sort of just, you know, a bit middling. What's the point in wasting time writing about something you just sort of feel a bit lukewarm towards?
Yeah, exactly. But what was the case with Art Lab?
But then with like, you know, with like a big show like a Whitney Biennial or Venice Biennale, you know, you want to have an opinion, and that opinion might be negative, might be mixed, might be positive. It's about being part of the conversation. It's important to be part of the conversation.
Yeah. What was the case with Art Lab? Was it Art Lab, the bad review that you wrote?
Yeah, that was the bad review I wrote.
Yeah, so what was the thinking going into that one?
That one, I think a colleague of mine had asked me to go and review it, and I took a dislike to it. Although, really, to be honest, I can't remember the details of how that got commissioned.
Got it. Okay.
I'm not avoiding the question.
No. I see. It was commissioned.
Can't remember.
Yeah, it was commissioned. It wasn't a choice. You know, I'm going to go write about this.
Yeah. At that point, that would be commissioned by someone else.
Right. Okay. Got it. Well, I feel like we've covered a fair amount. I was thinking I would ask you this in private, but what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you this bonus question after we sort of sign off, and that'll become a bonus episode. of the podcast for supporters of the show. So in the meantime, Dan Fox, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Michael.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Dan Fox for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And I will tell you in a second about where you can indeed get access to that bonus conversation we had. It's about how to reach out to art writers and critics when you have a show up, how to possibly get them to come. So that's going to come up in just a sec. First, we did have that somewhat heated debate. It felt heated. I sweat through my armpits when we were having that conversation. I talked to somebody on the inside at the Broad Museum here in Los Angeles, and it turns out that I did not miss anything by not seeing the Infinity Room show of Yayoi Kusama's at the Broad. So I feel good about that. I don't feel like I missed anything. Maybe it can serve as a potential warning to you if you're in a city where one of those shows is going on, because I know there are a couple of them at least. Or if you live here in LA and you missed it for whatever reason, let that serve as a source of comfort. Okay, so this show is a listener-supported show. We would very much appreciate your support financially as well as morally, if you will. And best way you can do that is you can donate to the show either via Patreon or via PayPal, both linked through the conversationpod.com/support. And in fact, if you donate $3 or month or more via Patreon or $25 one time via PayPal or more, you will have access to this newest bonus episode with Dan, in which we talk about how to write an email to an art writer. What's the best way to do it to get them to come see your show? At least give you the best odds of getting them to your show. He fields emails like these in the hundreds per day, I think. So let him serve as your guide. But you do need to join the ranks of the donating members for that. You can also support this show by becoming a follower on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. And you can leave a great review on Apple Music, iTunes, whatever it's called, one of those platforms. That is, so I hear, a way for other people to find the show. So thank you in advance for doing that. And feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions. I would love to hear from you if you have your own cultural associations with pretentiousness in TV, the movies, or elsewhere. And maybe we can talk about them on the next episode. All right, so now it's time to get to the Weiss link for the week. Here are three that I picked out for various reasons. First one, always start with maybe the most, I don't know, caustic, if you will, of the entries, and that is titled, "Is the Art World Rigged?" First of all, define art world. And second, who gives a shit about being in the Museum of Modern Art? The only art world I know is my art world. And believe me, you can be in it if you want, but it's full of bleachers and 1,000 telephones that do not ring. Richard Prince. Now, Jeff has been posting a lot of these pretty consistently Richard Prince blurbs. I know that he uses a subtractive process to come up with the text, but I'm not sure exactly where these are coming from. I assume it's his Twitter feed, but if anybody knows that, wants to inform me, that'd be great. Is Richard Prince not in the Museum of Modern Art, but he's in every other museum? That seems like a little bit of a contradiction, but in any case, I do appreciate the vision of the bleachers and the 1,000 telephones that do not ring. Next, are there any artists left in San Francisco? This is courtesy of Art Newspaper. San Francisco city government has launched an online census in an effort to find out how many artists and arts professionals have left the city because of rising rents, or just how few are actually left. Rents have shot up by 70% between 2010 and 2016, largely owing to the growth in the area of tech companies such as Twitter, Uber, and Airbnb, and calls for the city to stem the tide have become more urgent. Quote, "We hope this survey will give us a sense of the migration patterns of artists, but it's also going to help us support affordable artist housing," unquote, says Tom DeCaney, the director of cultural affairs for the San Francisco Art Commission. Quote, "I think the results will be shocking. unquote, says Kenneth Baker, who was the art critic for the San Francisco Chronicle for 30 years. Quote, artists are being driven further and further to the periphery, and you feel it. So that is a sentiment that I have addressed in all the San Francisco or former San Francisco-based guests that I've had. In fact, I have had conversations with three artists at least who moved down here. That was about a year, roughly a year ago, something like that. And others, a couple others who are still there, miraculously. Finally, the funniest one always lasts, something resembling truth, from William Poundstone, who does the Los Angeles County Museum on Fire blog. And it goes like this. In today's news, one, the LA Times says Jasper Johns isn't doing interviews for his Broad exhibition, something resembling truth. Two, the New York Times has an interview with Johns on his Broad show. Three, John says he agreed to something resembling truth because it would reach young viewers and, quote, I like that it's free, unquote. Four, the New York Times' Deborah Solomon informs Johns that tickets are $25. It's the Broad's permanent collection that's free. Five, John says, I don't think I knew that, and appears, quote, perturbed. Yes, poor Jasper. I always like to end with a little bit of wry empathy, I guess. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Jasper Johns is one of the most overrated artists, contemporary artists, in the upper echelons of the canon. Anybody agree with me? Anybody on board with that? All right. I think that's enough speculating for this week. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. Look forward to your financial and moral support and questions and comments. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.